Today on the Standing on the Shoulders of Giants podcast, we have with us Brian Ahuja, MD, who is a neurologist who I'm super psyched about having on because there's multiple different things that, boy, besides myself, I think a lot of people would like to know about the brain and the spine and all sorts of other different things that, you tend to work on. Beyond that, there's going to be some pretty breakneck stuff coming, not only in neurology, but also in medicine, having to do with artificial intelligence, which, of course, is the technology of the minute. So we'll definitely jump into that. Brian, would you like to give us a little bit of background? Let's dive in.
Oh, boy. it's always tough to answer that. Where to start? So as you mentioned, yeah, I am a neurologist. I am not a typical neurologist. I do telemedicine. So I don't actually see patients, because even when people think telemedicine, they think, oh, you're just evaluating somebody online, giving that prescription. All don't do that either. So I'm in a very niche field. It's called intraoperative neurophysiologic monitoring. So you know, all the different brainwave tests that neurologists do. So, you know, the standard ones being EEG, you know, check for seizures, EMG, you can check for muscle disorders, pinched nerve, all that stuff. So you can actually use that testing in the operating room. So patient's going to go in for, you know, brain surgery, spine surgery. They get knocked out. Anesthesia puts them under, sticking all the needles, get all the data. So actually what you want to do is get all the brainwave data before they start, so you get a baseline. And then afterwards, while they're doing the surgery, keep running the data, keep evaluating it, make sure everything's good so that when they wake up, you know, they're not paralyzed.
So clearly the
it can sound, I guess, a bit intense to, for me, this seems like, oh, it's just, you know, my normal everyday thing, because I do this all day every day. But I think, you know, when I start explaining it to people, and I realize, huh, I guess this is, it can sound a bit intense to the layperson.
Clearly, this is definitely pretty intense, at least for me it is. And it's basically you're monitoring my brain waves while I'm under. As an anesthesiologist, I guess, is monitoring the anesthesia in my blood. So first question is this: what do you do if you see some of the brain waves going in a direction you don't like? I mean, is this eyeball monitoring, or do you have software that helps, or?
I mean, people ask that too about, like, you know, do you have software? Do you have stuff to help you? Can this be automated or whatnot? I mean, that's a whole separate question altogether. I mean, right now this is all analog. So this is me looking at all the data, you know, with my own eyes constantly, having to give, you know, continual interpretations. And so, the hope is that you'll see everything, you know, unchanged. That's the goal. On occasion, yeah, you do see some changes, then you wonder, oh, okay. Could be sometimes, you know, a technical issue. There's some issue with, the needles of the software. Could be maybe that there is, you know, sometimes they'll go up in the anesthesia. That'll affect, you know, the brainwave patterns. For whatever reason, if they need to increase the anesthesia or give some, you know, some certain medicines. But sometimes, yeah, there is the possibility that there's, you know, it's a real change. Something happened. You know, could it be because of the surgery? Is there an issue with the blood pressure? We need to get the blood pressure up. It could be that, you know, there's like a pretty common thing that you'll see is where if there's like a malpositioned arm. You'll get the compression of the, you know, peripheral nerve, or, you know, the roots of the plexus, something like that. And so it's just a matter of positioning. So then they'll have to go up, you know, move the arm, sometimes do a few, you know, different adjustments to, you know, get in a proper position, which is still important because, I mean, there are instances where, okay, you're going in for a back surgery. So you're thinking, oh, you know, shouldn't be anything happening to my arm. And then, you know, someone could wake up and suddenly they have a, what they call flaccid paralysis. So it's just because the nerve is compressed so much. So it's like your arm going to sleep, but if it's a long surgery and your arm goes to sleep for a long time and they don't know about it, then yeah, you could end up not moving it. I mean, I think that's still a fairly uncommon occurrence too, but the neuro monitor that we do can help detect that. And then you can get it addressed right away. And then the patient wakes up, no problem.
I'm doing my absolute best not to make a joke about flaccid paralysis. So I'm just going to assume that means the arm.
The arm. Yeah. Well, it means like paralysis because of a peripheral nerve issue versus what's the other? It's flaccid paralysis and, man, see, this is the problem with when you don't do clinical neurology for a long time, you start forgetting some of the terms. So essentially related to peripheral nerve versus if it was, you know, paralysis because of an issue in the brain or the spinal cord.
Sure. So, honestly, yeah. Layman's terms is even better for us. That way we can just, we can understand things better. I understand that.
Spastic paralysis. That's the other word.
Fair enough. I just understand that, you know, you all tend to like a lot of Latin. I had to take Latin in high school and I would rather leave it in high school. So, so there is that.
Yeah.
So I guess before we start diving into some of these really amazing technologies that have come about in your field, and not only that, but like sort of discussing that, what made you get into this? Why was this interesting? I mean, I don't think most people go to medical school specifically knowing the discipline that they want to go. I mean, maybe some do, but from the folks that I've talked to, there's such a wide range of fields that you can go into. Why neurology?
Neurology. Well, so I actually am a bit unique in that I kind of knew going in that I wanted to do neurology. Yeah, because a lot of people go into med school and they don't necessarily know what they want to do right away, or they think they know what they want to do, and then it changes to something completely different, or they go through, you know, starting one rotation, like, you know, they want to go through like 50 different things. And I knew pretty set on I wanted neurology. And it's an interesting story how that actually happened. So back in college, I was a chemistry major, but my junior year, I discovered linguistics, the fact that you could actually learn not just specific languages, but just like language as a subject, you know, because I've always been interested in, you know, foreign languages and all that stuff. But I never knew that you could actually study just the field of language. Took an intro course my junior year. So they go through, you know, the different subfields of linguistics. One of the subfields I went over was neurolinguistics. So looking at the brain basis of language, and then learning about the different language disorders, you know, the different aphasias, as they call it, you know, Wernicke's aphasia, Broca's aphasia. So that's the one. Wernicke's is the one where if you have a stroke in a particular part of the left cerebral hemisphere or the left side of the brain, you just kind of start. Like, you know, it's just kind of gibberish and you can't really understand what people are saying either. Yeah, it's really weird. If you see, there's videos of this where you can see this. Like, it's complete nonsense.
I think this is one of the ones that it's something close to something that happened recently, I think, to Bruce Willis, correctly? Or correct? I think that was some type of aphasia.
Aphasia, and I think... And I forget which type. I think it was like an aphasia related dementia, if I'm not mistaken. So then, yeah, just most aphasias happen because of strokes. So just, you know, suddenly you lose blood flow to a particular part of the brain, and just suddenly that'll happen. I think with him, it was probably more progressive. You know, like just over a long period of time where that happened. If I recall, it's a dementia related disorder. So he probably had some memory issues and all that stuff related with that. So yeah, it's not a good thing to go through. It's not a good thing to witness either.
And then after undergrad, I guess, did you go straight into medical school?
Yeah, straight up. So because of that, you know, the linguistics thing. I ended up minoring in it. I should have majored in it, to be honest. I liked it that much. It was a little too late to do that point. But, you know, it did inspire me with, you know, learning about the brain and language and all that stuff. And I was like, oh, neurologists do this. They deal with these aphasias clinically. So that's probably what I want to go into. I had already planned on going to med school. Anyways, I was a pre-med at the time. But yeah, so that was even during my first years of med school, even preclinically. I wasn't the biggest fan of, you know, a lot of the other different subjects, you know, because you had to learn about the heart and the lungs. And I remember with the lungs especially, I was just like, just like, I don't like this. I don't want to do this lung stuff, this general medicine stuff. We get to the neuroscience portion and I was like eating it all up. I loved it. Went through that, went through my clinical rotations, my third, fourth year of med school. Some were okay. A few others I wasn't so happy about. Did the neurology rotation, loved it. So, it was pretty easy to decide there.
What was it specifically that you loved? You definitely come alive when you're talking about this. You can hear the passion in your voice. What was it that, like, you know, the air sacs weren't doing it for you?
I don't know. Because it's just like, okay, the lung, you know, yeah, it's like the lungs, the air sacs, the, I don't know. Every other organ system just seems very machine-like and just very, to me, at least personally, it seems very boring. I guess what's interesting, sorry, what were you saying?
Mechanical as opposed to electronic?
Yeah. Well, I guess, yeah, kind of literally in some sense too. The brain is really interesting because it's still kind of a black box. There's a lot we don't know about it. I mean, I guess that's a bit of a pro and a con. I guess the pro being that, you know, there's still so much to discover. The con being that, you know, it's not uncommon that you'll encounter, especially if you're at an academic medical center, which is where, you know, most neurology training programs are, you know, you get referrals, people coming in that at other hospitals, they're like, we have no idea what's going on. Then they come to us and then we have to try to figure it out. Even sometimes we're like, we have no idea what's going on. They'll be like, yeah, I don't know, 20-30%, where it's just, yeah, it's just weird stuff that is very hard to explain.
I've heard kind of a cool or maybe disturbing, depending on how you look at it, explanation for sort of like what are you, like if I put quotes around the word you, what are you? And it's basically, you are a brain and a spinal cord. That is what you are. That's it. Everything else is this spacesuit that effectively evolved around this brain so that you're able to survive in this oxygen environment. And if you were somewhere else, your spacesuit would look slightly different and so on and so forth. And it's basically like, you know, the eyes are so that you can perceive reality around you, so that your brain can perceive that, et cetera, et cetera. And so it was kind of interesting to think about that, because I was like, yeah, I guess that's kind of true. I mean, you're still you if you don't have an arm. You're still a person if you don't have legs. Like, you're still all of these things, but there is one pretty centralized portion, which is you. And then, you know, you end up getting this sort of these metaphysics conversations.
Well, where it's like, well, then it goes into this whole monism, dualism thing. I used to be of the thought that, yeah, oh yeah, it's just, you know, the brain and that's it. You're like the whole idea of Cartesian dualism and all was kind of, I don't know, like, you know, false or whatnot. There's no such thing as a mind. There's just a brain. I've kind of come around to the idea of there being, you know, is a distinction between mind and brain, because the way I look at it is that, the brain is, I guess, the substance for which you come out of. But I mean, being a brain is not enough. I mean, there's processes that are going on underneath that, I guess, where consciousness emerges. I guess that's the, because the still the problem is that we can't really define or say what causes consciousness. We're just, you know, we're here. I mean, there were like weird metaphysical explanations they try to give, you know, hundreds of years ago. And then now we try to give very, very science-y neuroscience, you know, oh, I remember one time I heard something about, you know, the microtubules of the cells of the neuron or maybe the locus of consciousness. I don't know. I still don't know how that can be proved. It's just, we're going from one kind of framework to another without actually any real advancement understanding how consciousness and you comes about.
Right. For sure. I mean, there's no question. We still can't really define this. But you know, that's sort of complexity theory. Like, are we more than the actual sum of our parts, et cetera.
Yeah.
That said, so you've studied the brain for quite some time. What are some things we take for granted that are not true? And what are some things that we don't think are true that might be true? So like, I mean, there's probably all sorts of things people have like about the brain and spinal cord that we take as truisms that are probably not necessarily the case. Are there specific things you can shed some light for the rest of us lay people on?
For true and not, could you give me an example?
Sure. Like the sky, a lot of people don't understand why the sky is blue. And it's like, well, actually the sky is blue because that's blue is the shortest wavelength. So it breaks up most easily in the atmosphere. But a lot of people don't understand why that's the case. Whereas with the brain, you know, I'll give you one example that I happened to learn from a different podcast, mine. Was Huberman's was if you basically look up, if you look up for like 30 seconds, you can basically trick your brain into not being tired.
I have heard that. Yeah.
Right. And he gives this huge, you know, this huge response on why that is and so on and so forth. But I was like, cool, that's the meat. I'll just look up when I'm super tired, which is great. But like, are there other tips, tricks, hacks, like various things that we can do? Because, you know, a lot of people, here's another one. Another one would be serotonin and dopamine are two words that basically weren't really in the layperson's language.
No.
At least, I mean, even 20 years ago, maybe 10, but definitely not 20 years ago. No one was really talking about that. And then all of a sudden, now we're talking about it left and right and center. I mean, this is at the center of a tremendous amount of topics, probably not just in medicine, but like even lay people are now discussing these various chemicals, et cetera. So what are some of the things we can glean from all this stuff?
Oh, man. Well, I guess in terms of the hack things, so you mentioned, you know, the eye going up. There's another thing you can do for preventing you know, like the ice cream headache. If you eat ice cream too fast, you go, because it's because the trigeminal nerve, so it's, you know, it's the nerve that, you know, goes kind of on your face and into your mouth, because it suddenly gets cold, so it gets that sensation and, you know, sends it to your brain, you get a big headache. So actually a way to fix that is you touch your tongue to the roof of your mouth and just hold it on there. Yeah, so it'll warm up the nerve on there. And then,
so the nerve is running through the top of your mouth.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's nerves running everywhere, but I think because when you're eating ice cream, so it's, you know, it's going in your mouth, it's hitting the roof of your mouth, it gets very cold. And so, you essentially just need to warm up that area. Yeah. And then the nerves will run through it. So you do that.
That's a good hack.
Yeah. You know, another interesting hack I learned, if you're like lying down and you're just like, you want to get up, or you're just really, really tired, you don't feel like you want to do it. Because I guess mentally you'll feel like, you know, oh, it's such a, you know, like a huge, thing to have to lift my whole body up. So you start with just, you know, like your pinky. So just wiggle your pinky, then wiggle, you know, fourth finger, middle finger, just keep doing it progressively. So fingers, then you do the hand, then you start doing the forearm and then the arm, and then you do the other side. And then, you know, it's that kind of build up. So you kind of start the movement, you know, in a little area, build it up, and then that gives you the energy to kind of want to get up. I've used it a few times. It's it's more of a persuasion trick, I guess. That's kind of, you know, how I learned about that. And so, you mentioned the dopamine, serotonin stuff. One of the issues I have with the way that we talk about all the neurotransmitters is that because everything kind of gets reduced to just, you know, oh yeah, you know, dopamine does this, serotonin does that. I think that's kind of how they initially had thought about all this stuff when they were even, you know, making all the different medications that would target, you know, oh yeah, this is supposed to increase serotonin, it's supposed to increase dopamine. But I don't know. I feel like a lot of that is very, I think it's too simplistic, and it's more complex than a lot of people realize.
In what way?
I mean, it goes back to the whole thing of, you know, we still don't know everything about the brain. And so it's just, I think when it comes to talking about anything within the human body, to say that, you know, oh, you know, one particular chemical is the key to, you know, to doing, you know, this thing or that thing. Like, you got to be a bit careful, because there's so many processes going on in the body. The body is so complex. You know, there's so many downstream effects that you may not take into account or realize or know about. I mean, that's the whole thing with, you know, when you have new medications that will come out of the market, but, you know, there's always going to be potentials for side effects. That's why they have what they call, so when a medication comes out, it's gone through what they call, you know, stage one, there's like stage one trials, stage two trials, stage three trials. So those are, you know, very regimented, and they try to, you know, make sure, okay, they do all the stuff in the lab, they do clinical trials on people, and then they deem it as safe and then put it on the market. But then you have what's colloquially known as stage four trials, which is then seeing, okay, it's on the market, but now, you know, how does this, like, does it actually, you know, work the way we think it does? Because you think, you know, oh, we didn't see much issues with the stage three trials in terms of side effects, but then put on the market and sometime down the line, it ends up being that, oh, because drugs have been taken off the market during these, you know, these stage four trials, so to speak, because something ends up happening that we just didn't know about or couldn't take into account. And so, I don't know if that makes sense at all, the way I'm explaining it, but, The human body is very complicated, and I think to reduce things to just, oh, this is dopamine, this is serotonin, this is, you know, norepinephrine, all that, it's not so simple as much as we'd like it to be. I think there's always this need or this want to try to have, you know, clear, simple explanations, and sometimes it's not so clear.
Well, we are human.
Yeah.
We are human.
Yeah,
we want pretty simple explanations. So back to what you were saying when you're doing this telemedicine. I mean, if you see a brainwave go haywire, or, you know, whatever term you would use, I mean, in your telemedicine, you know, I'm guessing you're zooming in. What are you doing? Are you just like, are you sounding a bullhorn? Be like, all right.
Kind of, yeah. So
put the scalpel down.
Well, yeah. I mean, so there's a direct chat communication I have with the, because there's a technologist in the room with the surgery team that's, so they do the deal with the technical side, putting on the electrodes, gathering the data. There's a screen share that I have, so I can see the technologist screen, see all the data in real time, and then I can make assessments in real time. So most of it's through kind of like an instant chat messenger thing. There's a special platform we have for that. Occasionally, if there needs to be, you know, a phone call for discussion, then then I'll do that. I always give them my, you know, my work cell number, let them know, you know, if you need to talk to me, I'm here to chat. So occasionally you have to do that with the technologist, sometimes with the surgeon too. But yeah, if there's a high suspicion that, yeah, this is something surgically related, then, you know, you got to let them know, get the recommendation about what to do, whether it's something related to surgery or something related to anesthesia, to the blood pressure.
I know there's a couple of different procedures where they actually keep the patient awake during certain things. I think it's certain types of brain surgery, and then you're showing them like colors and cards and various things. This is also a neurologist, correct? Is this similar? Can one take the place of the other one? What is that like?
Well, so that I did those in my fellowships. I did my neuromonitoring fellowship at Stanford, and we would do about one or two of those a month. Awake craniotomies is what they call them. So usually, okay. And usually the reason you would do them is if a patient had a tumor near the language centers in the left side of the brain, so one of the risks with doing those surgeries, so you want to take the tumor out, but it's near the language center, so there's a high risk of aphasia, a high risk of actually causing a language, you know, problem because of the surgery, which obviously you don't want to do. So there's no way to have a patient asleep and assess their language. I mean, you have to be awake and talking. And so then that's where, you have a special, we had a special specialized neuro anesthesia team at Stanford. So they specialize specifically with neurosurgical patients. And so they're all cocktail concoction of stuff they'd give to, it was a very fine balance between, you know, kind of keeping the patient, you know, at least sedated enough so they're not going to be moving too much, but not so much that it knocks them out and you can't talk with them. And then you'd have talk with them, you'd have conversations, you would have them, I don't know, count to 10. Yeah, you have the different cards, there'd be photos or stuff to read. And you're just constantly doing that throughout the whole surgery while the neurosurgeon's doing his thing. Those can be a bit intense too. And that's not something that like you do remotely. I mean, you need to be in person for that kind of stuff, for language assessments and all.
Yeah. So can what you do today, which is the brainwave monitoring, can that take the place at some point of doing something of this nature, to where it's like you would know that you're getting close to affecting some type of waves, et cetera?
You're talking about having this take place
of the awake
stuff. I mean, not in the way that we currently have it.
I'm guessing you wouldn't want to do it then. It doesn't make sense. I don't know. Again, I'm asking.
I mean, I can't see a way to. Unless a patient is awake doing it, I don't. Where they're awake and you can talk with them, I don't see how you can. You know, with the stuff that I do with the current tools that we have for neuromonitoring, how that can replace that.
Okay.
Yeah.
How many different types of brainwaves are there? There's more than a few, correct?
Oh man, yeah, because there's. Well, I mean, there's different ways that you can look at. So you have, I mean, the standard one everyone thinks of is EEG. So that's the one where you're typically, if you're looking for, patients with epilepsy or looking for seizures. So that's activity of the brain, the cortex, so the outer layer of the brain. You have one for the brainstem. So it's brainstem auditory evoked potentials is what it's called. So essentially you get these tubes you put into their ears, the patient's ears, and these little clickers that'll, you know, just do click, 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 clack. You know, the ear will pick up the sound, you know, we'll go through the whole auditory pathway in the brain, and then you can actually record essentially from the brainstem, you can record, you know, that brainwave of sorts coming through. There are a couple other ones that we call evoke potentials. They're brainwaves of sorts, so that's a little different. So obviously, you know, evoke potential meaning, so you're inducing the wave. So there's one that's called a somatosensory evoke potential, or SSEP. That's the shorthand for it. You'll actually put stimulators on the wrists and on the ankles, and so you'll stimulate there and then pick up the signal on the brain. So that and that's more to actually check the pathways in the spinal cord, because you know all the sensory fibers and the motor fibers, you know, they're all branched out into the limbs, but then they all come together up in the spinal cord, go up into the brain. So we use those a lot for spine surgeries, which tends to be the majority of the surgeries that we do. And then the opposite direction, so that you do a motor evoke potential or an MEP. So then you stimulate at the head, you give a little shock at the head, and then you record at the muscles. And again, that's checking the motor pathways, both in the brain, but more so in the spinal cord. So again, using those, especially in spinal cord cases.
I recall an experiment quite a long time ago. I mean, I'm sure we would consider it to be pretty rough or brutal these days, but I think some guy had an open head wound or something. Something happened where they were literally intentionally stimulating certain areas of the brain.
Yeah.
And then someone would start either singing, or they would evoke a strong memory, or it was pretty wild. Yeah, like, do you recall
smells or something like that?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess depending on which part of the brain you stimulate, I mean, I guess it depends which part of the brain they're at first. And then, or you can actually do, if you're in the motor cortex, or the part of the brain that deals with movement, you can sometimes induce, you know, kind of movement to see like a hand twitching, or maybe, you know, an arm movement at all. So it's crazy stuff. So, like, when you see that kind of stuff, you realize just how you know, complicated and amazing the brain is.
For sure.
something we take for granted, I think, a lot. I don't think we realize how integral everything we do in our lives is due to an intact brain.
So you were talking about EEG brainwaves, and this is what most people think about. It's got the Greek letters. It's got delta and theta and alpha and beta and gamma, et cetera. So a couple of different questions on that. I actually have a number of different questions. First of all, just for all those cat lovers out there, isn't something weird about cats' brains that they're always in alpha state? That's something weird.
Is that a thing? Yeah, I think I remember you telling me that before. I didn't know that was a thing. I don't know much about animal brain.
I have to double check that, because I might be full of crap, but I've heard that before.
So they're just always awake, I guess. I don't know. Because alpha's usually the standard when you're awake and, you know, you're not sleepy, you're not drowsy. That tends to be the standard wave that the brain will have.
So, which brings me to an actual question, because I don't know. We should Google this afterwards to see if cats are actually alpha, always in alpha state, because I could be completely wrong. That said, I think it's maybe just when they're awake. Anyway, my question is, if you have two different people, a man and a woman, a kid and an adult, it doesn't matter, just two different people, or even for that matter, two similar people, would the EEG brainwaves be like radically different for those people? I mean, obviously it's going to depend, like obviously it's different if they're asleep or if they're awake or if they're just waking up. I'm sure of that. But at the same time, I'm also wondering, like, does it vary due to personality type? What if someone had, what if someone was bipolar? What if they were schizophrenic? What if they were, you know what I mean? Like, for each one of these sort of nuances that a human being could have, and not just the extremes, like I was saying, but like, what about if someone is very artsy and another person is very, very mathematical focused? Like, are there brain waves wildly different between those people?
That's an interesting question. So I have to preface, I'm not an EEG expert in the sense of, you know, because I do it mostly in the context of neuromonitoring. So, so it's not, I'm not familiar in like the latest research with all this stuff. I mean, as far as I know, I mean, in terms of different personalities and all, I don't think EG is, or at least the standard way EG is done, can really differentiate between that. I mean, the biggest differentiator you'll see with EEG is by age, because babies and little kids have EEGs that are radically different from adults. I think like probably after around age, 10 or 12, then it's, it's like teenagers EEGs will, pretty much look like standard adult EEGs. But yeah, with like babies, especially, it's like, from 0 to 1 week, it's this stuff. From 1 week to 3 weeks, it's something else. From 3 weeks to 6 weeks, and I don't know, it's a whole stratified thing that confused the hell out of me. And I had to do a few months rotating through pediatric neurology. That's a requirement for all adult neurology training programs. But yeah, I couldn't make heads or tails of any of that. Yeah, totally. And I wasn't going to be a child neurologist, so I don't think it was expected of me to, to know the finer details of all that stuff. But yeah, so by age you can do it, but not by like by gender or by personality, like even different psychiatric diseases. I'm not sure. Supposedly you can use EEG. You have to use like quantitative EEG. There's some like special, like advanced EEG techniques you can do, I think, for like with ADHD, I think. But that gets into like kind of, very more like advanced technical stuff that is completely out of my out of my wheelhouse.
You know what? Let's go out of your wheelhouse. Yeah. Let's shift gears here. Uh-huh. I'm not sure this is actually out of your way. By the way, I Googled it real quick. I think cats are almost always in alpha mode. So
interesting. Even when they're asleep. Yeah, that is a bit weird, actually.
Supposedly, that's the brainwave that's like most often thought of, like with transcendental meditation and people who claim psychic abilities, et cetera. Anyway, cats are awesome.
Psychic cats. Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, I like cats. That said, there have been some really strong advances in medicine with artificial intelligence. I know this is a subject that you're pretty interested in. Is there things in your field or the things in other fields? Like what are the things that are coming? Because again, for the lay people like me, like we're always interested in this stuff. This is always really exciting when it's like, can I turn into the bionic man? Are you going to be able to make me an X-Man with gene editing? Are you going to be able to or for that matter, how about a soldier who is paralyzed? Is there a way we can get that person's legs? You know what I mean? Like there's a lot of stuff inside of there where it's like there's some really amazing things besides like the cool superhero powers. How about just like being able to fix us better? So what kind of things are coming down the pike that are interesting in your opinion?
I mean, I don't even know where to begin with all this stuff, because it seems like all this AI stuff just suddenly boomed in the last couple months. Or at least like the discourse for it. I mean, it's been going on for a while, but then like suddenly, I think with all the ChatGPT stuff, because that came out, I guess in its current incarnation, that came out when, November of last year? Yeah. And because this is what kind of really tuned me to, okay, we are definitely in the AI era and there's no turning back, because about a week and a half ago, I was at a conference down in Austin. And it was a subspecialty neurology conference, actually more related to, all the neurophysiology, EEG, MG, intraoperative monitoring. So kind of within my, subspecialty. And, no less than two or three occasions did the topic of, ChatGPT come up during the lectures. And mind you, these are, subspecialty physicians and all, but they're not, these aren't like tech people. These aren't people that are, medicine in general tends to be, medicine as a field tends to be very conservative. I mean, it's full of Luddites. People are very, very, very slow to make advances. It always feels like medicine is 10, 15 years behind. So then to hear people talking about ChatGPT just a few months after, it came out. And not only that, there was actually a block of lectures on well, it was dubbed AI and Epilepsy. And there were like the second two lectures, they dealt more with kind of some technical stuff on diagnosing epilepsy and all that stuff and using AI. But what was really interesting was the initial lecture where it was more of an overview on AI and medicine. And during that lecture, they brought up something, you know, caught my attention. There was a new app that came out called DocsGPT, D-O-C-S-GPT. And it's part of the Doximity app, which is it's like a social, I guess like social media for doctors. And, you know, you can have like a fax in there. You can make phone calls from there and all. I have a fax number in there. I don't use it much, but I saw this, I started like playing around with it and looking at it. Right now it's nothing clinically related. Like it's not made for being asking questions. So I was looking at this this DocsGPT app, and it doesn't, as of now, it's not made for, you know, anything clinical where you can be like, oh, the patient has this symptom, what's the diagnosis? I wouldn't at this point, I don't think it's good enough to give it, you know, that much trust. But a lot of it actually had more to do with dealing with a lot of the admin side of medicine. So like, you know, for instance, a insurance company has declined coverage for medication for your patient for, you know, whatever reason. And you want to give a appeal letter to be like, you know, hey, this patient has this condition, they need this medication, should be covered. I mean, you could query that into the DocsGPT app and it'll spit out a, you know, a full letter right then and there. Maybe you have to, you know, look at it, edit it a bit or whatnot. But I mean, the fact that it can do that, I mean, because just think of the possibilities. I mean, one of the things, I've talked to a few people about this too. Can you integrate this into electronic medical records? Could it just be able to deal with all, you know, the notes and documentation that we have to do? Because right now it's, I mean the whole documentation structure, everything with electronic medical records is kind of a nightmare. I mean a lot of the notes end up kind of being completely useless because it's just, you know, it's just, there's all these preset things in there that, I don't know, for certain regulatory reasons you have to have certain things, and so it just ends up being, even if it was just a simple encounter where it's just, oh, you have a cold, you know, and then, but, you know, and that should be simple enough. And then what'll spit out is like this, like 5-page thing of gobbledygook that makes no sense. Sorry.
You know, just to comment on that. I mean, basically, as far as medical records, the technical answer is yes. The HIPAA answer is probably no, because you can't really merge them all. I've had some experience with HIPAA. Can't really merge all that stuff together. That said, you know, we say we're making a lot of advancements in AI, but really what it's doing is I have a whole episode on this called Zen and the Art of ChatGPT, but it's really just, it's a probability engine. Mm-hmm. And then, by the way, for the doctors that are listening, do not put medical things that you don't want out there inside of ChatGPT, because ChatGPT, it uses RLHF, which is reinforcement learning with human feedback. It snarfs all the stuff that you put into it as well. So if you paste code in there, and Samsung found this out the hard way, by the way, this week, if you paste code into ChatGPT, yeah, they now have snarfed up that code. Don't put secret algorithms and stuff in there to try and check it. It's not a good idea. Samsung found out that, wait, they have all of our code now, and it's, some of the responses it's giving us is actually giving us back things that are in our code that we didn't tell it about. It's like, but you did tell it. You told it in a different chat, and it made the model better. That said, it's just a probability engine. So again, it can spit out garbage, but it can also spit out really good stuff. As far as DocsGPT, yeah, if you're only training it basically on medicine, and you're limiting it to that area, it'll do some really interesting things. It won't take the place of diagnoses whatsoever.
No.
But yeah, I can absolutely write you a letter saying, hey, here's what I want to have happen for this patient to, you know, to get their stuff. So I don't think that's a bad thing at all.
No, I think it's great, because I mean, one of the banes of the work for all healthcare professionals is the documentation of the paperwork. I mean, that was a big issue I had with it when I was in training. I mean, that's one of the reasons I kind of went the more non-traditional, you know, non-traditional route of, you know, working from home and kind of just sticking to a very, you know, niche field, because it's one of several reasons, but the paperwork issue is just a nightmare. And the fact that this could potentially alleviate, I don't know, 50%, 60%, 90%. I don't know how much you can alleviate, but like any alleviation is going to be, I would think, like heartily welcomed and embraced by, you know, everybody in medicine. Because seeing the potential for that, you know, even just that, I was just like, wow, this is like, I don't see anything, you know, I don't see us going back from this at all. And again, the fact that just a few months after ChatGPT kind of, you know, came on the scene, or at least like in its current incarnation, that they're already coming out with some, you know, kind of medically related ChatGPT. Because again, in medicine, people don't like, it's usually very slow to embrace new things and change. So the fact that this came out so soon is, it was a bit surprising and eye-opening for me.
So that's one of the things that I'm actually really hopeful on, is that folks in the medical field will actually specifically understand where this is coming from, where it's not going to take your job. It's going to make your job easier. The whole point of it is to do pattern recognition. That said, it seems like it would be an amazing companion specifically for what you do. I mean, if the whole job is pattern recognition of brainwaves and to see when they go haywire, it seems like some type of pattern recognition engine would be amazing for that.
Of sorts. I mean, the thing is, because I've talked to, because I have a couple cousins who are in tech, and I was chatting with them some months ago about this too, because they were asking the same thing. Oh, could there be any automation in what you do? And I was like, I guess maybe, but because the kicker with what I do specifically is, it's not just analyzing data, but it's analyzing data in real time and giving feedback in real time and then having to reassess in real time. Because it's different for, as compared to say, like a pathologist or a radiologist, because I know the AI has been used in those fields quite a bit. So, you know, I guess for like in radiology, I think, was it like with mammograms, I think that they've been using a mammograms or like chest x-rays or CT scans, you know, so they can help detect very subtle things that may be a bit more difficult to see, you know, the regular human eye or, but there's, I mean, that's just, again, they don't have to do it in real time. It's just, you can kind of, you know, feed it in and it comes back on its own pace, you know, okay, this is what the diagnosis may be or whatnot. I'm actually not sure exactly how it works. And with the stuff that I do, it's because it's very, you know, quick and very time sensitive. So can AI deal with that? I have no idea. I don't know.
Yes.
Yes? Really?
Yeah. I mean, I would probably need a sample set of a few thousand brainwaves. I mean, obviously the more the better. But as soon as I get someone like yourself to start marking the deviations, I can train the set. And then, it would be able to respond to effectively everything in real time, instantaneously. To be honest with you, it's pretty easy. I mean, those are waveforms. Waveforms are really easy to look at.
Yeah.
Because computers generate them in the first place. So it's easy to analyze. That said, are there other things, like sort of even outside of your field, that you're pretty psyched about seeing in the medical field and diving in with new technologies and whatnot. And for that matter, are there specific disciplines in medicine? I can't imagine it's all doctors. I know it's a huge swath, but I can't imagine it's all doctors that are Luddites. Are there certain ones that tend to embrace technology quicker and faster?
I feel like kind of the younger generations are tending to, I mean, millennials, Gen Z, because we're growing up in a rapidly changing world. So I feel like there's probably more embracing of all this stuff amongst, you know, the youngins. The boomers, maybe less so. I mean, I don't blame them too. I mean, if you're used to doing something, you know, a certain way for, I don't know, 20, 30, 40 years, it's going to be very difficult. And especially if you're not really keeping up with all the tech stuff too. I can't blame them for not wanting to embrace stuff. But I mean, at some point it's going to have to happen. People are going to have to, you know, embrace this. I mean, I think the way that medicine is going to, if all the stuff with ChatGPT and AI kind of, you know, goes the way that I think it may go, because I had a combo with another friend about this too. His prediction was that, essentially the doctor kind of becomes more of a project manager of sorts. So you're kind of like, there's some synergy with the AI or the language model, whatever, where it may be doing, you know, a lot of the grunt work, and then you got to kind of, you know, oversee it and double check it. But it's a very different skill set from how, you know, doctors are traditionally trained. I think the whole education system is going to have to be completely revamped, because right now, historically what's been traditionally valued is being able to memorize just a bunch of facts, bunch of stuff, and be able to regurgitate. The problem is too, is that there's too much information, and it keeps piling up, and there's no way to keep track and keep up to date on everything. It's impossible. And then you have a, you know, an AI that has it all right there. If you can kind of bring it up, then what's the point of memorizing everything? I think what's going to have to be valued is, you know, people who know how to think properly. Critical thinkers. And he described it as like what's going to be needed are high EQ engineers, which I don't know. I don't know how many of those there are, but it's not a bad characterization, I guess.
Sure. I think it's a rare bunch. That said, I think it's getting bigger, especially like you said, with the younger generations. The other thing that I would definitely sort of tack onto there is it's serendipitous, or for that matter, coincidental that you said that. A lot of folks, very recently, actually, a lot of folks have been really diving into this educational system and just saying on one level or another. I mean, I've talked to folks all the way down at grade school, all the way again through, just like you said, through medical school, who are just like, this stuff, it's got to change. It's got to change with the times. We need a pretty massive overhaul. So that's been a pretty constant theme recently. Is there something, speaking of that, is there something that you would change in medical school? Like if you, again, not that you have to want to quit your job or anything, but like hypothetical, if you go back to medical school and you were like, all right, here's how I'm going to swap all this stuff in and out. Are there certain things that you would swap in and out?
It would have been nice to have done. At least when I did med school, because I started back in, you know, it was like 2008. It was 2008 to 2012. It was definitely, you know, a very traditional model of, okay, the first 2 years are what they call the basic science years. So you're pretty much just doing book learning the whole time, and then the third and fourth years are when you are in the hospital doing your rotations and all. Part of me wonders if a lot of that book knowledge stuff from the first 2 years because I don't know, some of it seemed very extraneous. I barely remember a lot of that stuff. And again, because, yeah, I mean, especially now, I think that being able to regurgitate stuff ad nauseum, I don't know how great of a or useful a skill that is with all the technology, you know, coming out. I think that could be truncated a bit, you know, maybe like a year and a half of that, and then you start with your clinical rotations a bit earlier. I mean, some people talk about, oh, you could probably even arrange it so that you wouldn't even have to do it in a full 4 years. You could maybe even do like three and a half years, you know, because it would help to, I mean, if they could, if there's a way to truncate it in a way that wouldn't diminish quality, then you can get people out there into the field sooner. You're not extending the amount of time that people are, you know, studying and not being doctors, I guess.
Sure. Okay. Definitely an interesting route that could potentially be pursued. I mean, yeah. I'm not sure this is in a ton of Western countries, but there are a number of countries out there that actually have a Bachelor of Surgery. And the specific reason is you effectively learn the book learning, and then they're like, okay, now go apprentice, because surgery, there's no other way to do this. But then beyond that, they're like, by the way, the reason that you don't have this like tremendous medical knowledge is the same reason in the United States, when there's a surgeon in the room, there's also not a surgeon. Like there's also what you would call like a drug doctor in the room as well. And it's because the surgeon doesn't really need to know any of that stuff.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's really just, no, the medical doctor is there, the Bachelor of Surgery. It's like, I don't really care what this guy knows. What I really want is like his hands to be super steady. And I want him to have done this like 4,000 times. Yeah. Right. Like that's the most important thing. As far as what drugs are going through my body, leave it to the other guy. That's the
that kind of. I mean, that kind of happens here in the U.S. too now.
Is that right?
Well, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't trust a surgeon to deal with, you know, patients' medical problems. Is probably last thing you want is like an orthopedic surgeon, you know, dealing with somebody's diabetes. That used to be an issue in a lot of places where, okay, you know, patient is under an orthopedic surgeon's care in a hospital. And then a lot of patients are sick too. You know, they're not just there because they have a broken bone, but then, you know, they also have, you know, they're overweight, they have diabetes, they have this, that, and the other. You know, surgeons are not going to be able to deal with all that stuff. They want to do surgery. They don't want to, you know, have to manage, you know, this, that, or the other. So a trend you're kind of seeing now is that patient will come in. Yeah, they're a surgical patient, but they will be admitted under, I guess like, you know, like a doctor service, a hospital service or something. So there's a medical doctor overseeing their general care, to make sure that, you know, on the medical side, everything is good. And then the surgeon is just there to do the surgery. And that's really how it should be. I think outcomes are better when it's that way. Yeah.
So in that vein, I guess the question becomes, because I've actually wondered this myself, if you have some unknown medical problem, let's just say it's unknown, and you put it in front of eight different doctors and eight different specialists, or in eight different fields, is the oncologist always going to see cancer? Is the surgeon always going to see something to cut out? I'm like, does everybody cloud and shade their views with these inherent biases they have because this is what they do all day?
Yeah, probably. I mean, you only know what you know. So if yeah, you're a heart specialist, someone's coming with you with some issue, I mean, you're only going to know the heart stuff. You're a neurologist, you're going to only know, well, hopefully you'd know some of the medical stuff with it, because there's a lot of, well, because in neurology, I think it's still good to have a good foundation of, you know, general medical stuff. Although, I mean, but again, it's hard to know all that stuff when you're dealing with just neurology stuff all day. I've heard of that where, yeah, someone will go, or a patient will go. I don't know if it was someone that actually had an issue, or it was like a fake patient, or someone who pretends they're having some issue, and this was just kind of a test to see how how they would be diagnosed. Yeah, and then different people give their different opinions, but it all tends to be kind of shaded by their their specialty because that's what they mostly do.
Sure. Yeah. So in your career, can you, obviously, you know, we don't want to know patient names or anything like that. Let's keep it all confidential, of course.
Yeah.
Can you talk about some of the cases that you've seen? Like, are there any that stand out in your head, good or bad or whatever?
You're talking with neuromonitoring or just in general neurology stuff that I've...
Let's open up to the whole field.
Oh, man.
Everything.
Well, in terms of the general neurology stuff, I mean, that's a number of years ago. I mean, strokes, epilepsy. Okay, so an interesting case that I had one time, and this was a couple of years ago, I was monitoring a case. I think the patient was there for some standard surgery. I think they had a slip disc, like an L4-5 on their lower back. So standard surgery. We're doing the baselines, getting the brain waves. And we're doing the SSEPs, the somatosensory vocal potential. So, you know, stimulating at the wrists, at the ankles, recording at the head. And so we notice on the SEPs that we can get a signal from the neck, but we weren't getting a signal from the head. So, because when you stimulate at the wrist, the ankles, it travels up the spinal cord, you know, so it'll travel, you know, up through the neck. You have a lead there. You can get the signal from the neck. But what's supposed to happen also is that it's supposed to go up further, you know, into the cortex, into the head, and then you're supposed to be able to get a signal from the head. We weren't getting a signal from the head. And the surgeon asks, oh, is the patient having a stroke? And I was like, well, I mean, this is, I was like, was there an issue with the blood pressure? What's going on? I mean, everything was fine, stable. I mean, and this was baseline too. It's not like we got it and then we lost it and there was a change. And so it was just like, I can't say for sure that it didn't have a stroke. I don't know what's going on. Surgeon cancels the surgery, has him get, has the patient go for imaging. I hear the next day, the patient had, what's known as, I think it was schizencephaly. So it's they've had this since birth. It never got diagnosed because, I mean, the patient never had any symptoms or whatnot. But there was like a hole in her brain. And actually, not just a hole, because a hole would be porencephaly. Schizencephaly, there's like an actual, like, I don't know. There's like, it's just, there's just a piece of the brain that just looks like it's missing almost. And I think it's a developmental thing where just during development of the brain, for whatever reason, it just wasn't there. But I guess the rest of the brain developed okay or was able to compensate so that there were no symptoms. So they, you know, nobody ever had a need to do a brain scan on her. And it was only when when we were doing, you know, checking the brain waves, we were like, oh, there's no brain waves. And that was the reason why. Yeah, it was very odd. So, I mean, there's no issue with it. Then the patient came back for surgery later and we did it, but it was just, you know, that's like one of the rare instances where neuromonitoring actually helped to diagnose something.
It's a good one.
It's kind of nuts. Yeah, if you look for pictures of it, if you type in schizencephaly online, you can find some interesting photos on it. It's kind of crazy.
That's wild. So, moving away from the brain for a half sec, How do we repair spinal cords? I know that we can't really do that like outright now, but like, how would we, right? So give me some speculation on, is this going to be a CRISPR thing? Is it going to be gene editing? Do we have to figure out how to use stem cells?
Stem cells. I mean, again, there's a little out of my wheelhouse there, but yeah, I would imagine stem cells or some sort of gene therapy. I mean, because the problem is that you can't, I mean, the body can't repair neurons. When your neuron dies, it dies, whether in the brain or the spinal cord. So, I mean, I guess to fix it, you would have to make new neurons, which I guess stem cells are probably pretty much the only way you could do that, right? Yeah. I don't know another way. I mean, I'm not sure of any other way. And then how you go about doing that, that's a whole other thing too. I feel like this is kind of very futuristic, you know, way way out there in the fringes.
Yeah.
Well, that would be amazing if you can get to a point where, yeah, you could cure paralysis. I mean, that would change the game. I don't know.
I agree. But that's sort of the point. So you think it would be some combination of stem cells and gene therapy? Again, it's just speculation.
Yeah, it'd have to be. I mean, because it'd have to be whatever can help create new neurons and create new, you know, connections. Because again, yeah, the body can't make them.
So when I think of neurons, I think of things in the brain that are sort of firing these electrical connections. But you're saying that those are all the way down, the way through the tailbone, effectively. So neurons are
they're neurons in the spinal cord also. Yeah. So there's like different because there's neurons in the brain that will, and then the fibers go down from the brain to the spinal cord, and then they connect with neurons in the spinal cord.
And the neurons in the spinal cord are mostly for locomotion, correct? Some type of motion, as opposed to the ones in the brain, which is for all sorts of stuff.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you have some motor related neurons in the brain also, but many other different neurons in the brain. Yeah.
Got it.
But it's mostly motor in the spinal cord. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk some brain fundamentals. Everybody always says gray matter, but they don't realize that the brain also has white matter.
White matter.
What's the difference? And is it really gray? Is it really gray versus white? Are those the actual colors, or is this just
I think
terminology?
No, I mean, I think it's fairly gray and white because of the if you do pathology slides, so the way they'll stain them. I forget what exactly they use, but yeah, so it'll appear the neurons will appear gray. So the gray matter being so that's the cortex, the outer part of the brain, and then the inner part of the spinal cord. So that's where the neurons are in the spinal cord. They're actually within. And then the white matter are the fibers that come out of the neurons. And they're myelinated, as we call them, myelinated fibers. Myelin is a protein that surrounds the fibers. It helps to speed up the conduction of the electricity through the nervous system. And so, that's the main difference. So gray matter being essentially neurons, white matter being the fibers that come out of the neurons.
You said what's the white matter made of?
Myelin. So that's the essentially like a membrane or sheath around each of the fibers.
Very pedestrian question, but is there something that I can eat that like the white things grow better or whatever? You know what I mean? I'm always looking for hacks to like how do I turbocharge the brain?
Your myelin. I mean your nervous system is pretty much myelinated by the time you're. I mean, definitely by the time you're a teenager. I mean, you're continuing myelinating as a child, and I think up past like, I don't know, 6 or 8 or something like that. So I mean, once you have it, you have it. Okay. I don't think there's much. I mean, the issue can be so a disease that involves myelin is for instance, multiple sclerosis. It's a demyelinating disease, as they call it. So. And that can lead to problems there too. So, if you have MS, you need to get that properly treated. I mean, it's not like you can eat something to to grow it back. Because it's an autoimmune disease. But your body's just attacking it. So it's, you gotta get that under control. But assuming you don't have MS, you should be fine with your myelin.
I want more of it. I mean, how do I do the reverse of that? I mean, let's myelin it up over here. Are there certain things that can end up turbocharging the brain in one way or the other? I mean, some people Some people say even rudimentary caffeine is something of a neurotropic, something of this nature. Is there other things that are sort of brain healthy? I think they fish oils.
Fish oils, yeah. So like, I don't know. There's been some controversy on fish oils because you need to make sure that it's a good quality fish oil. Because I think they've done studies on a lot of the over the counter fish oils, and a lot of them tend to be rancid.
Yeah, is it just better if I just eat sushi? A lot of sushi.
Yeah, food is always best for getting nutrients. Right. So yeah, all the fat, yeah, in terms of like the omega-3s especially. So the and DHA is because there's two main.
I need to eat a lot of sake toro.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Salmon or I think mackerel has a lot too. Herring, and wild fish too. If you can procure that, farm fish I think tends to be a little bit more, iffy. The whole neurotropic thing. I don't know. I think some people kind of go a bit overboard with it. I mean, one of the best things you can do is making sure you get a good night's rest. I think a lot of people don't get enough sleep. I think just being able to do that does wonders. I used to be a bad sleeper, terrible sleeper. And once I kind of got that in order, it did a whole, load of good. Not just for making your brain work better, work faster, but just in terms of, general mood too. Sleep, being out, getting, some occasional sunlight, vitamin D. The caffeine's, caffeine can kind of help. The problem with caffeine, because I know you mentioned the caffeine thing. Your brain can get adapted to it pretty quickly. And then it doesn't really work so much as a cognitive enhancement, but as a way to kind of like maintain, because then if you stop it, then you start getting, you go into withdrawal, and there's a whole issue with that. But yeah, I think general lifestyle, good general lifestyle habits go a long way. I think trying to overdo it on the nootropic stuff, your mileage is going to vary.
Sure. Personally. I mean, it's just popular. I mean, we're humans. We want to do the least amount of work possible. It's like, minimal effort, maximum impact.
Yeah. Right?
That's the mantra.
That is the human condition, for better or for worse.
For sure. Okay. So what would someone want to, obviously the answer is medical school, of course, but like, what would someone do if they were interested in this type of field? Like, is this, are there particular things that people can go look at? Obviously they can go to medical school and actually become one, or like, what does someone want to do to be a neurologist?
If you want to be specifically, like a medical doctor, neurologist, then yeah, you gotta go through the whole grind of, med school and applying for med school and, doing all that and then applying for residency and all. If people are, if you're interested more in the kind of the science side, the neuroscience side, then, you have the option of going that way. So you don't have to go the clinical route.
Because I can't imagine a bunch of people listening are going to like go to medical school because of a whim. So
yeah.
If we wanted to learn more about the topic, like what are some interesting spots?
For neuroscience specifically, nothing I can think of off the top of my head. I'm sure there's so many, blogs out there. There's a lot of neuroscience stuff you can find on Twitter. That's where I find most of my information at this point for everything.
Is that right?
Twitter. Well, no, Twitter is where, it seems like that's where a lot of the interesting people are. There's a lot of crazy people on Twitter too, but there are the occasional, smart, insightful people. you know, that talk about, you know, various interesting topics, neuroscience being one of them. I mean, for someone who's like, you know, a young person who's wants to go into neuroscience, I mean, you could, I mean, in college, you can major in neuroscience. I mean, that's a, you know, an option in terms of a major. And then you're kind of going more the kind of the lab route, the clinical or the I don't know what the proper term is for that. But yeah, but essentially you're kind of, yeah, going the more research route, I guess, as opposed to the more clinical route, which you do going to med school. I mean, you could do both also if you really wanted to get an MD, PhD. I don't know if that's, that's a lot of time. That's like 7 years just for that. Before you even do any of the residency training and all too. So some people do it.
So you've mentioned a couple of different ways that you're doing monitoring when a patient is under. And you mentioned attaching sensors to wrists and ankles, and then I guess measuring them if you can get those signals and they register somewhere in the head, I guess.
Yeah.
I imagine there's a bunch of different ways that you do these things. Can you somehow measure visual as well? I mean, is it all the senses? Is it different types of sensors? The body is also electrochemical. So like, is some of it chemical as opposed to electric? I don't know. I mean, what does that look like?
I mean, visual, there are, yeah, you can do visual evoked potentials. It's not super useful for neuromonitoring. I mean, they're very difficult to get. I mean, especially in a sleep patient. Usually that's more done with awake patients in an outpatient setting. If you're trying to assess for, yeah, they may have some type of visual field problem. And then there's a special standardized way of doing. Yeah, it's like kind of like a check mark thing. They have to, you know, stuff will flash, and then you have the put a like electrode in the back of the head. Because it's the occipital lobe, so the back part of the brain that deals with visual information, recording it that way. So for diagnostic purposes, yeah, you can do that, assessing vision. In the operating room, it's. I mean, I've tried it a few times; it's never been successful. Yeah, it's just the nature of how it is. Yeah, I mean the
sensory auditory.
Yeah, the auditory. Yeah, so the brainstem thing. That's the brainstem of potentials. I'd mentioned that a little bit earlier too. So that's the way to measure auditory. That's easier to do in an intraoperative setting. Those can also be done in a clinical setting, outpatient, if you know someone has a hearing issue.
So it means you can still hear things when you're under.
Well, I mean the signal is going through. I mean you're not. I mean hearing in the sense.
It may not be registering.
Yeah, right? Yeah,
it may not
yeah,
be
yeah.
in your conscious
but,
mind.
Yeah, but, like, yeah. But I mean, but the process is happening. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, same with like, I mean, you're paralyzed, but yet, you know, you can still check the, you know, the motor pathways too. Yeah. And you're not, I mean, assuming you're under enough, you're not going to feel it or remember it or register it. Same thing with the sensory too. You know, it's all... Yeah. You can all still get it to work even if you're not aware of it. So I mean that's how most of the body is. I mean most of the body is working without your conscious awareness or you know conscious volition.
Sure.
Yeah.
I think if it was, all of us be dead pretty quick. So like beat heart beat.
Yeah,
So I here's an odd question, but I have to ask because I have more than a few in the family. Mm-hmm. Given my particular heritage, and that is, do you have to do different things to redheads just like the anesthesiologist does? Do they have weird brain waves? Are these you know daywalkers?
I've heard something. I mean, yeah, I don't think there's any difference with the brainwave stuff or whatnot, but I've heard of that too with redheads. There's, yeah, something related to that. I don't recall exactly.
With anesthesia, that's a very real thing.
Yeah,
very real thing. It takes quite a bit more to put them under they don't feel pain in the same way. It's a whole thing. I've got a number of cousins, aunts, uncles, so like I'm very aware of this issue.
No, yeah, I guess for that maybe. There must be some genetic thing related to that, I would imagine. But
it doesn't affect their brain waves, so they are technically.
I've yet to learn about her. I mean, I can't tell. I mean, unless like I'm like, you know, I'm given patient information, you know, I'll see the waves and I'll be like, okay, these are the waves, but I don't know if it's a man, woman, you know, redhead, brunette, blonde. No way to differentiate that, you know, right now, at least.
Fair enough. So again, we explored some things sort of in your field. Are there other things in other parts of medicine that you're excited about having to do with like newer types of technology or like things that are coming out? Like what's exciting to you?
Oh man. Been out of it for some time. So I haven't been keeping up with, I mean, I know like with like neurology in general, there's just been a whole lot of, I mean, the field has changed so much in the last, I mean, how long have I been out of residency? Like 7 years, 8 years? Like it would be so difficult for me to go back to clinical practice at this point, just because, I mean, the rapid amount of change that's happened, I feel like it's completely different from, you know,
well,
when
what
I
changed.
I mean, I know with like with multiple sclerosis, there's been like a whole slew of new drugs. Like the big trend I've been seeing, just I guess with well in neurology and like I guess medicine in general is the use of, you know, biologics, using the antibody therapies. Yeah, I mean, it's like everything, like all this like gene related antibody, whatever. It's just it's insane. I mean, there's one that came out recently for like migraines. Apparently, there's like a. some like I think it's for migraines. Yeah, some antibody treatment, you know, for that. I mean, for all the different, you know, autoimmune stuff or cancer. I mean, I think that's going to be the big. I mean, even now, like you're seeing huge changes with, with like the way cancers are treated. I think like certain cancers that, you know, 20 years ago would have been like a death sentence, now, you know, people can. I mean, I don't know if it can be like a full cure, but, you know, can, you know, make more recovery than, you know, they could have. I mean, I think at some point, if, I mean, with all the advances with gene therapy, it seems like we'll get to a point where we can kind of individualize therapies for people. So it'd be like, oh, you have, you know, this type of cancer, this particular autoimmune disease, whatever, you can kind of tailor it just to that specific person. I don't know how long down the line that would be, but I think the whole, people talk about personalized medicine. I think that's where I see all this heading. It's going to be, yeah. No, it'd be great, because then it's, you know, you can kind of tailor to your particular problem. You know,
that's good. I'm really excited about that. I'm super excited about the potential of personalized medicine as well. I think it's I definitely believe it's the future. That said, what were the antibiotic things that you were talking about? What does that look like? In what way is how would an antibiotic, again,
antibodies.
Okay, so how would an antibody treat a migraine? What does that look like?
You see, and this is, again, because...
Or I mean, for that matter, or MS.
MS, I mean, or whatever. Tell me, yeah, no, wherever. I mean, like in the case of MS, so if I recall correctly, because you have, it's autoimmune, so you have the body's immune system attacking, you know, the nervous system, the myelin specifically. So you can actually use the, and it involves the, you know, the different cells, things like B cells, which are the ones that produce the antibodies that will attack you know, your brain, your spinal cord. And then there's, at least the ones that had come out when I first started, I know there was essentially the antibody therapy, and then it, I guess, attacks or helps to neutralize, you know, the B cells. So your body's B cells that are attacking your own body. So essentially it's trying to, in some ways, neutralize at least a part of your immune system that's causing the issue. I'm trying to think with the others. I don't know, because I think there's like 8 or 10 of them now. It's, I don't know if they all attack or deal with, you know, different particular cells or what, but you can potentially, if you know, a cell has a particular, you know, marker on it per se, you can essentially get. Sorry, I don't know if I'm explaining this properly. This is getting all like I'm like digging deep in from and now I lost my train of thought.
Oh, no worries. We were talking about antibodies, but the thing is, it definitely seems like there are some strong pushes.
Yeah.
From both the antibody side and, for that matter, from the personalized medicine utilizing gene therapy and stem cells, et cetera, moving forward, which is super exciting. I can't wait for that to occur. Last question. Hmm. If there was a technology that you could blink into existence to do with your field, you don't have to develop it. There's no cost, no nothing. You could just blink it into existence. What would that technology be?
Oh, man. Mm. You know what would be interesting? So this would be, it's more so for like, you know, a general neurology thing, but like a pain detector or something. This is one of the issues, or just like
I think I recall seeing a Black Mirror episode like this.
I don't know, because it could be a blessing or a curse too, I guess. I don't know if it's like even not so much with pain, but I guess some way to like measure qualia, I guess, if that's you know, like measuring subjective experience, because that's the issue sometimes too, is that, you know, a patient will have come in with you know, there's something going on, some kind of, and it's hard to tease out because there's nothing, at least, like, you know, like sticking out, it's just, oh, there's some, like, you know, like flagrant physical issue going on, but, you know, they feel something, you know, pain, some discomfort, this, that, or the other. And it can be, I mean, sometimes it can be very difficult to figure out exactly what's going on. I mean, it could be that, I mean, there are instances where a patient could be faking it, but I mean, that gets into the whole, like, I mean, that's like,
more like, but a measure that they're faking
psychiatric thing. I mean, there's certain ways. I mean, that's like, I mean, you want to make sure that you assess properly and I mean, because there's other reasons to why someone would be, you know, faking and stuff too. Because I mean, there's a lot of like psychiatric issues related to that usually, or but yeah, a qualia measurement device. I don't know how to
which is interesting,
yeah,
because basically it's like irony incarnate that you would even say that, because one of the whole points of qualia is that it cannot be measured,
I guess. Yeah.
But I hear you. That's not a bad choice for any of that stuff. So Brian, this has been awesome. I really appreciate your time. Let me ask, are there particular socials where people can follow you or get in touch or any of that type of stuff?
I mean, my main thing is Twitter. So I'm at Brian Ahuja. That's, you know, my full name. I'm completely doxed. I started Twitter, you know, a number of years ago, and, you know, I was just on it with myself, and just, that's kind of you know, how it was. So just stuck with it. But yeah, that's the main one if people want to get in touch with me.
All right. At Brian Ahuja at Twitter. This has been great. Thanks so much, brother. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
For those listening, we have been standing on the shoulders of giants.